This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Wednesday, January 29th.
The impeachment trial is now entering a very interesting phase with a new format for the next 2 days, and then a high-stakes day on Friday when they'll decide on whether to call witnesses. The big news story going into today, in case you haven't heard it yet, is the Wall Street Journal report that Mitch McConnell admits that as of now, he does not have the votes to block witnesses. That comes after excerpts from John Bolton's forthcoming book got out, tying the president directly to a Ukraine quid pro quo. And then if they call John Bolton, who else will the Republicans choose to call? They have the votes. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Before they get to the witness vote on Friday, today and tomorrow, senators are submitting questions in writing for the lawyers on either side to answer. Chief Justice Roberts will read the questions out loud. Yesterday, the Chief Justice recalled the Clinton impeachment and said how he would like this to go.
During the impeachment trial of President Clinton, Chief Justice Rehnquist advised counsel, quote, counsel on both sides, that the chair will operate on a rebuttable presumption that each question can be fully and fairly answered in 5 minutes or less, end quote. The transcript indicates that the statement was met with, quote, laughter, end quote. Nonetheless, managers and counsel generally limited their responses accordingly. I think the late chief's time limit was a good one and would ask both sides to abide by it.
Can the questions and answers be brief? It was a laugh line there for Roberts. And will they be clarifying for you, the American public, or just grandstanding via index card instead of via tweet? We will know as today and tomorrow go on. We'll invite you to submit questions of your own now on the phones after the 6 days of presentations by House managers and White House lawyers that contain so many arguments and so many details. We have an expert guest who we hope will be able to answer your questions. All we ask callers is that you ask a specific question about either side's arguments. Don't just make a political speech. The Senate is in question and answer mode, and so are we. Our answer man guest for this is Ryan Goodman, professor of law, politics, and sociology, big portfolio, at New York University, and co-editor-in-chief of the website Just Security, which focuses on national security and international law, and has been following the Trump-Ukraine story in great detail. Before joining NYU, he served as special counsel to the Defense Department in 2016 and 2015. He was a professor of human rights and humanitarian law at Harvard, has served on the board of advisors for the U.S. Naval War College, is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and more. Professor Ryan Goodman, good to have you back. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me on.
And let me start where I think we are. The facts are decreasingly in doubt. Trump directed aid to be withheld and meetings until Ukraine announced investigations of the Bidens and Ukraine's involvement in the 2016 election. So if we assume that much, the three-day Trump defense presentation indicated to my ear that we'll hear a lot of these main talking points going forward. One, personal self-dealing in foreign policy is normal. Two, there was enough smoke surrounding the Bidens that a fire investigation was a legitimate ask. And three, if the president did something wrong, it wasn't bad enough that the American people should be deprived of their right to reelect him or not this fall. Here's White House counsel Pat Cipollone on that.
They're asking you to remove President Trump from the ballot in an election that's occurring in approximately 9 months.
And that is a big deal. Removing a president involuntarily, which has never been done in this country, and when he's up for re-election to boot. And I tend to think, Ryan, that a debate over that question is where all this is ultimately headed in the Senate after the next few hoops. And so that's my 30-second super squashed summary of the last 3 days and where I think it leads us. How did you see the Trump defense team setting up the Senate votes to come?
I think that's right, that the best final line of defense for them is that the facts are really quite bad, so that they might end up having to say, yes, he did it, but it's for the voters to decide. It's not for the Congress to remove him, especially when we're this close to an election. And they can determine for themselves whether they think this, within the package of all the other things that the president can offer them or not offer them is something that they want to stay with for another 4 years, or punish him for, or remove him for, but not this chamber.
Yeah. Now let's get to specific questions, and I'll start with one or two. On your website, you co-authored, and listeners, you should know this, about just security and why it's definitely worth a look. Ryan co-authored a very detailed timeline, very detailed, beginning in 2013, of what he calls Trump, Giuliani, Biden, and Ukraine Gate. Now, since the Trump team just finished, let me play a clip from their Biden argument. And Democrats won't like that we even talk about this, but judging from our phones and how much play this gets in conservative media, the defense believes they have something to run with, at least politically here. So I'm going to play a clip of Trump defense team lawyer Pam Bondi from Monday and ask you to give us as much context as you can to either debunk it or amplify it. Attorney Bondi says that a State Department email from 2016 describes a Ukrainian consultant asking for a meeting with a U.S. State Department official to discuss why the U.S. considered Burisma corrupt. Bondi said the Ukrainian consultant explicitly invoked Hunter Biden's name as a board member, according to the State Department email that was later released.
To be clear, this email documents that the U.S. government had determined Burisma to be corrupt. And the consultant was seeking a meeting with an extremely senior State Department official to discuss the U.S. government's position. Her pitch for the meeting specifically used Hunter Biden's name. And according to the email, the meeting was set for a few days later. And later that month, on March 29, 2016, the Ukrainian parliament finally votes to fire the prosecutor general. This is the prosecutor general investigating the oligarch, owner of Burisma, on whose board Hunter Biden sat. 2 days after the prosecutor general is voted out, Vice President Biden announces that the U.S. will provide $335 million in security assistance to Ukraine. He soon announces that the U.S. will provide $1 billion in loan guarantees to Ukraine.
Trump defense attorney Pam Bondi on Monday. So, Ryan, that was kind of the heart of this piece of the Trump case regarding why they're trying to argue that it was legitimate to seek a further investigation of Joe Biden. Are you familiar with that State Department email, and what other factual context can you give us for that?
Right. So I think that there are two separate lines of analysis and parts of the timeline that people should, in fact, keep separate and then think about whether or not there's a relationship between the two. So one is the unethical behavior of Hunter Biden in going in joining this firm, and from all accounts, a highly corrupt firm engaging in criminal activity, while his father then is the point person for the U.S. government on Ukraine. So unethical behavior, swamp-like activity that crosses the partisan line because they kind of all do it. And, you know, if you're going to point a finger at him, let's also look at what the Trump children do. And that's bad behavior. The second part of the timeline is, what did Joe Biden do as vice president vis-a-vis the prosecutor and things like that? These are two separate things, and I think there's a strong argument for the ethical misbehavior of Hunter Biden. There's no argument for did Joe Biden do something wrong slash criminal, and there's the problem for them. That was a smear of Joe Biden. It is based on nothing. For those of us who are much more familiar with what happened with John Kerry when he ran for president, like swift boating, it's actually taking a person's strength and then flipping it. The strength of Joe Biden was that he led with the rest of the entire government an effort to oust the prosecutor, in part because, get this, the prosecutor was not going after Burisma and in fact engaged in a cover-up of Burisma's crimes. And that's why they did it. And they did it explicitly. And George Kent, who's an eminent person within the State Department, one of the most senior officials currently in the State Department, testifies before the House and lays that out, as well as what we have in the documentary record.
The argument that they're trying to make, and you're comparing it to the swift boating of John Kerry, calling a strength a weakness as a piece of misinformation, they're trying to argue that there was something there in the timeline that Pam Bondi laid out. This consultant for Burisma asked for a State Department meeting, invoking Hunter Biden's name, gets the meeting, and then days later, they vote in Ukraine to fire the prosecutor general, who Biden has been the lead person on, you know, wanting to get out for the U.S. and the EU and the IMF. And then suddenly, boom, there's all this money that's going to Ukraine.
Right. So I would say, if anything, if I were to put those two data points together, I'd say, isn't that remarkable? Even though Burisma gets the meeting, they throw out the prosecutor who was covering for them and put in place a prosecutor who is supposed to go after Burisma.
So, but they do say that Shokin, the fired prosecutor, was investigating Zlochevsky, the owner of Burisma. Is that true or false?
False. Wasn't doing it. The case was closed, and they thought that the next prosecutor who took over from him would, in fact, open the investigation, and he kind of did, and then he also closed it. And in fact, the special prosecutor's staff, Shokin's staff, had engaged in what was also referenced by Ms. Bondi. There was the United States was helping the UK in its investigation of the Burisma's owner. The investigation was going along swimmingly, a criminal investigation of the owner, and then the prosecutor's office staff sent the UK court a document that said, Burisma is clean. We've investigated them, they're clean. And the case was booted out of court. And that deeply upset the U.S. officials, State Department, and Joe Biden. And that's part of the reason they went after him. And in fact, right around the same time that Joe Biden goes there to try to push out the prosecutor, the U.S. ambassador, who's still a U.S. ambassador right now in the Trump administration, makes a statement, a speech in Ukraine. And he says, specifically, they're concerned with the special prosecutor's office as they're covering up for Burisma.
We've been inviting listener questions about the evidence to our voicemail line on Impeachment, a Daily Podcast. And here's one of those questions now that has come in.
My name is Ryan. I'm calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Impeachment is pretty severe in that it should be taken care of at the next election. But I've never heard anybody ask the obvious follow-up question, which is, doesn't that only apply to first-term presidents? Does his bar for impeachment lower for second-term presidents?
Pretty interesting question, and it goes back to the first clip that we played today of Pat Cipollone, the White House counsel, making what I think is going to be the closing argument, no matter how long this goes, just as it was the closing argument yesterday. Even if President Trump did something, is it really the right punishment, and is it a punishment of the American people to remove him from the ballot for this close at hand election, and therefore remove the people's choice? And so the caller asked an interesting question. Would the bar for impeachment actually be lower in a second term?
So I think that it's a great question. I've kind of thought about it myself, never written about it or said anything about it, but it's because it's only in the back of the mind, but it's great to bring it to the front of the mind. Because if that's the argument that the remedy is re-election, then how does that even apply to a second term, and therefore maybe we would lower the bar? I think that can work well, and even it doesn't work as institutional politics, it might still be just the way in which we intuit about the situation, just so much that I think that also probably affected the House's game plan as to why they didn't want this to be drawn out, because the closer you get to the actual election, the potential for re-election, this argument is even stronger. I do think that...
And we should note, just as a matter of curiosity and historical context, this is kind of an abstract question, right? This is kind of a theoretical question. Is the bar for impeachment lower in the second term, or should it be after the people have had their last chance to weigh in the ballot box? Well, the Clinton impeachment was in his second term, and the Nixon impeachment was in his second term.
Right. And as a formal matter, there's no difference. Like, you look at the Constitution, how is it supposed to apply? It is just a remedy, because you can't wait necessarily the stretch of time for the voters to decide again if it is about a re-election. And there's no reason why you're kind of upsetting an election if, in fact, the official has engaged in political corruption. Just to give an example, so we had a piece written by former White House counsel Bob Bauer in Just Security about this. He looked at the rules for the senators themselves, which say that if they were to exchange legislation for political favors, that can count as political corruption, and by their own rules, they can be expelled from the Senate. Nobody would say you're denying the voters the choice in that matter. In fact, it's kind of recognizing the voters' interest, but unfortunately for the voters, they don't have the ability to do so in the moment, and they shouldn't have to wait around, especially if it's that kind of a political corruption where it's using some ways, they're using their office to stay in power. So I think that's an important dimension of this particular impeachable offense.
Here's another question submitted to our voicemail for Impeachment, a Daily Podcast.
I don't understand why holding funds from Congress isn't against the law. I thought it was. So I don't understand why he's saying that that's not impeachable. I get his other arguments, but I thought that if it was proven that Trump had himself withdrawn those funds, then he was going against Congress, and that's not lawful. So that was my question.
Thank you for that question. And that's a great question. And for people who've been paying close attention in recent days, they know that the Government Accountability Office has just recently issued a formal opinion that the White House was breaking the law by withholding this aid for Ukraine that had been authorized by Congress. You can't do that. And yet, the White House lawyers made the case over the last 3 days that you can't impeach the president because no law has been broken. And that may not be right either. They admitted that the majority of legal scholars believe that impeachment doesn't have to be only on a statutory crime. But they argued that there was no statutory crime. And according to the Government Accountability Office, there was a crime.
So it's definitely the case that the Government Accountability Office, which is an agency for Congress itself, so it's nonpartisan agency, made the determination that the president, in fact, did hold back on congressionally appropriated funds, taxpayer money, illegally. Just a clear statement by the GAO, and the statute is the Empowerment Control Act, and that in fact is the statute that was in the mix in those unredacted emails between OMB and the Pentagon, because the Pentagon was telling OMB, you're violating the law and we can't do that. And in fact, at a certain point, the Pentagon said, we just have to disperse the funds because we can't stand for this violation of the law. And one of the lines in the GAO report that I think hasn't gotten enough attention is so significant. They were obviously very deliberate in what they decided to write at the time, because it was only issued in January this month. They say that it was not only that the president violated the law, but he violated it in a way which he shouldn't, because his constitutional duty is to faithfully execute the law. The constitutional duty of faithful execution of the law is in the Articles of Impeachment. It's in the Articles of Impeachment for Clinton. It's in the Articles of Impeachment for Nixon. So the violation of that core duty of the office of the president really is the core of the abuse of power. The only piece that I would add to this is something that's odd in a certain sense is that the Empowerment Control Act is actually not a criminal statute. So there's no criminal liability for it. So if the president's team is making the argument that it has to be a crime, then they don't need to worry about the Empowerment Control Act. If their argument is instead it has to be a statute or settled law, which is a little bit of the Dershowitz argument, then they're out of luck. And it's almost gaslighting to suggest that argument, because kind of everybody in the room knows that it's a violation of the Empowerment Control Act.
And I see that you and Andrew Weissman, this former lead prosecutor for the Mueller team, have an article together now on just security called Why the White House May Not Dare Fight on Executive Privilege. And I think you're anticipating something that's pretty likely to come up, because it's starting to seem likely that the Senate will call John Bolton to testify. But the president has said publicly that he may well invoke executive privilege, that his conversations with his former national security advisor, Bolton, are privileged conversations with the president of the United States, and he would block Bolton from testifying on those grounds, or at least testifying about certain specific things on the grounds of executive privilege. So now your and Andrew Weissman's new article says why the White House may not dare fight on executive privilege. Why not?
So the reason why not is, and let me just back it up one bit to say, apparently there are multiple Republican senators who have concerns that if they subpoena Bolton, then the White House invokes executive privilege, and then it's this long drawn out court litigation. So our point is, No, there's a very strong reason that the White House would never want to risk court litigation, because there is an exception to executive privilege, which is if the information being sought contains evidence of a crime, that's an exception, and then you can allow for the information. So the point is that the federal court in D.C. would probably say to the White House, are you sure you want us to invoke executive privilege? Because then we have to decide whether or not the allegations against the president involve criminal activity. And I think that would be the very last thing that President Trump wants, either during an impeachment hearing or ever, for a federal court to say there's sufficient evidence that this is actually a crime, multiple crimes, bribery, election law crimes, et cetera. That's the reason that if I were one of his legal advisors, I would say I'd kind of wave him off of that approach, and therefore it might be just a bluff for him to say, and for them to say, that they would invoke executive privilege.
Ryan Goodman, professor of law, politics, and sociology at NYU, and co-editor-in-chief of the website Just Security, which focuses on national security and international law, and has been following in great detail what they call the Trump, Giuliani, Biden, Ukrainegate story, including a very detailed timeline that starts back in 2013. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.